Good evening and welcome to the third chapter of this opening event on the second day, actually. And it's a great pleasure now to have two additional speakers for tonight. First, Andrew Hirscher, and then Abdoumalik Simon. We'll start with Andrew, and Andrew will talk about a topic that is very urgent and highly discussed these days in Germany, but I guess all over the world. It represents a major topic that we will all have to deal with. The lecture is called Humanitarians' Housing Question, From Slum Reform to Digital Shelter. And I think Andrew has been working on this topic for a couple of years now and very intensely looking into some of the contradictions around that topic. Andrew is an associate professor at the University of Michigan, and his work explores contemporary spatial politics, concentrating on architecture and urban formations of political violence. Some of this, his work, took place in former Yugoslavia or the post-Yugoslavian conflicts, and which also turned into, or will turn into a new book, as far as I understand. Or is it already out? No, it will soon. About its books on the politics of monuments in and after the breakup of Yugoslavia. Also, there will be a project on the urban decline in Detroit, which is something Andrew gave us a kind of first insight into for our book on international case studies. I think a really, really interesting contribution about the, also about the racial or racist context of what is called the urban blight. But today he will talk about this, it's not, certainly not a new phenomenon. It's migration has been on the globe for forever, but it's, I think now people start to realize the urgency of that problem, and I guess there's partly very little knowledge actually about what's happening on the ground and what are the effects on architecture and how it might also influence the very role of architects and also relief organizations all over the world. Please give a warm welcome to Andrew Hirscher.
Thank you, Nicholas. It's really a great pleasure to be here and to at least try to contribute to this incredibly rich conversation that has unfolded here these last 2 days and nights. And in light of those days and nights, I'd also like to thank all of you who are, still here. I'm grateful for your presence. The topic that I want to discuss with you tonight is the relationship and non-relationship of humanitarianism and housing, which is to say a topic that could be called humanitarianism's housing question. And as I think Nicholas's introduction suggested, it might be difficult or impossible or even absurd to try to address this topic, especially here in Berlin now, outside of the context of the current refugee crisis. I'm not going to explicitly or extensively deal with that crisis, but my hope is that in a kind of brief exploration of the history of humanitarianism's housing question, that this exploration could, let's say, offer a particular perspective on that crisis, nevertheless. But let me begin in the current moment, when much of the attention that is being paid to the refugees who are struggling to come to Europe and stay in Europe is attention that is being paid to the material boundaries and the political frontiers that refugees are struggling to cross. And here I'm talking about the barbed wire fences, the hastily constructed walls, the lines of police, the lines of soldiers, and of course behind all of these, the immigration regimes of the European states, both those in and out of the European Union. But refugees are also struggling across and I would say soliciting the reorganization of other sorts of borders, of disciplinary borders, of conceptual borders. And one of those borders I want to suggest is that between humanitarianism and architecture. And what I mean by this is that, in a sense, by rejecting refugee camps and asking for refuge in European cities, refugees are refusing to be contained by the spaces of humanitarianism, the policies of humanitarianism, the logics of humanitarianism, and are instead asking to be included in the spaces, the policies, and the logics of architecture. And one of the things that might actually render this situation a crisis is that it involves the refugees' refusal of a humanitarianism that is typically deployed at the margins or beyond the margins of Europe, and a demand for housing in Europe's cities. And so to paraphrase Friedrich Engels on the housing question, this refugee crisis gets talked of so much only because it does not limit itself to the refugees, but it has affected the petty bourgeoisie also. In other words, what Engels is I think, suggesting is that refugees are always in a state of crisis. And so this term, refugee crisis, is not pointing at their crisis, it's pointing at the crisis of those of us who are affected by their presence. And so among the many, many things that this crisis solicits, I think, is a history. And a history that attends to this crisis as in some way prepared by the historical itineraries of humanitarianism, of housing, and of architecture. And what I'd like to suggest tonight is that this history is one in which humanitarianism and architecture were, until remarkably recently, enmeshed with one another. That this is a history in which humanitarianism and architecture shared a common preoccupation with housing, and that this is a history in which each discipline, in a sense, constituted its radicality in a kind of self-abolition in the fulfillment of the other. In other words, that radical humanitarianism was in effect a kind of architecture, and that radical architecture was in effect a kind of humanitarianism. And so my hypothesis is that, read against the grain, that the history of humanitarianism was, from the outset, the history of what you could call the housing question. And this is a question that humanitarianism has subsequently abandoned, but it's a question that the refugees who are struggling to reach and remain in Europe are struggling to once again pose. Histories of humanitarianism typically don't begin in cities. They typically begin on battlefields, and they typically don't begin with distressed refugees, but with injured soldiers. And a very typical origin point of these histories is a battle that took place in 1859 in Solferino. This was a battle in which primarily French forces defeated the Austrian army. It so happened that a Swiss businessman named Henri Dunant visited the battlefield after the battle was over, and he was horrified by the scores of injured soldiers that he saw lying there unattended. And that experience, in a sense, shifted his itinerary so that he spent much of the rest of his life carrying out a series of initiatives that yielded, among other things, the first Geneva Conventions and the founding of the International Red Cross. And these are precisely the events that typically inaugurate humanitarianism's history. But precisely at this time, precisely when these initiatives were being developed, a parallel series of initiatives was staged in response to a different experience of suffering. And this was an experience of the suffering of the working class in England's industrializing cities. And this was suffering that emerged in the context of what Friedrich Engels called a social war, but that others, and these were both people in the working class and the bourgeoisie, that others at various moments in early 19th century England saw as simply war. And the consequences of this social war, or this war as such, were often mediated through housing. In other words, through investigations of working class housing conditions and calls and proposals for housing reform. Now, it's true that the term humanitarianism was not used in Victorian era housing reform discourse, but there was a term, now unknown, that was used, and this is the term humanity monger. And this was a term that was deployed both critically against Victorian era reformers, but also affirmatively by those reformers themselves. In both cases, this is a term that I think both anticipates the emergence of the term humanitarianism at the end of the 19th century, but it also points towards what I think is a kind of counter-history of humanitarianism, a counter-history that begins in the 19th century industrial city. And so, traveling through and reporting on industrializing cities in the north of England in the early 1840s, a commentator, William Cook Taylor, was critical of what he called humanity mongers, who advocated the end of child labor without recalling that labor brings wages and wages bring bread. But we are humanity mongers, wrote the English reformer Thomas Beams a few years later in support of an attempt to replace London's rookeries, or what we would today call slums, with model housing. And while Marx and Engels, writing in the Communist Manifesto, explicitly distinguished themselves from humanitarians and also from philanthropists, utopians, organizers of charity, improvers of the conditions of the working class, members of societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals, and many, many other contemporary do-gooders besides, nevertheless, Engels addressed the working classes of Great Britain, and this was just a few years earlier in the condition of the working class in England, in the only section of the book that was written in English, as, in his words, members of the great and universal family of mankind who know their interests and that all of the human race to be the same. In other words, this was a humanitarianism in statement, if not explicitly in name. The writing of people like Cook Taylor, people like Beams, people like Engels, was part of a voluminous discourse in Victorian England, a discourse that was composed of magazines and pamphlets, newspaper articles, commission reports, books, and legislation on what Engels, along with many less recognized others, called the condition of the working class. And this was a condition that was often addressed through working class housing, the inadequate and dangerous housing that the working class was forced to occupy, with danger here sometimes understood with reference to the occupants of that housing, occupants who are threatened by disease, threatened by crime, threatened by immorality, but also sometimes with reference to the middle class and the upper middle class citizens who found themselves threatened by those occupants. In a notable account of English housing reform written by an architectural historian named Robin Evans, Evans pointed to the image that you see here, which is the only image in a book written by an English housing reformer, Hector Gavin, in 1848, called Sanitary Ramblings. And this image, as you see here, is a section of a hypothetical lodging house in a distressed neighborhood in London called Bethnal Green. And what it shows, according to Hector Gavin, was drunkenness in that middle, the middle of the image, sexual promiscuity in the attic where unrelated and related adults were sleeping together, and the kind of conditions of disease in the basement of this dwelling. What Robin Evans says in relationship to this image is that it describes what he calls the intimate bond between physical degradation and moral degradation. But I think the image also testifies to another sort of intimate bond, and this is the intimate bond between humanitarianism and architecture. In other words, housing in the guise of these kind of debased examples that were documented by reformers that you see here, but also in the model homes that were proposed by other reformers, housing was the medium in which Victorian humanitarianism represented the social problems it addressed. These were problems like poverty, immorality, epidemic disease, social hygiene, labor unproductivity, political instability, as well as, in many instances, the solutions that they proposed to those problems. Looming large among those so-called problems that Victorian humanitarians addressed was what they called the moral failings of the working class. What's important for me here is that these failings were, according to these reformers, visible in working class dwellings. And so in James Grant's 1837 book, The Great Metropolis, he pointed out that working class dwellings were places where, in the great majority of cases, scenes of wretchedness are the result of intemperate and improvident habits. Or similarly, in another book about London's working class that was published in 1853, the author declared to his readers that wherever in London a rookery exists, we may be assured that it is inhabited by the Irish. Or, reporting on Manchester, Cook Taylor pointed out that even the factory operatives are badly lodged, and the dwellings of the class below them are the most wretched that can be conceived. But what he concluded was that this great destitution and delinquency arises from a class of immigrants and passengers. Or similarly, in another book, Peter Gaskell's Artisans and Machinery, and this is a book that Friedrich Engels relied quite a lot on in his Condition of the Working Class, Peter Gaskell described the poor of Manchester as debased alike by penury, want of economy, and dissolute habits. Another one of Friedrich Engels' direct predecessors, James P.K. Shuttleworth, wrote in a book called The Moral and Physical Condition of the Working Classes Employed in the Cotton Manufacture in Manchester the following. We have exposed the condition of the lower orders connected with the manufacturers of this town because we conceive that the evils affecting them result from foreign and accidental causes. A system which promotes the advance of civilization and diffuses it as all over the world, which promises to maintain the peace of nations by establishing a permanent international law, this system cannot be inconsistent with the happiness of the great mass of people. So in other words, here, precisely in inverted form, was the kind of systemic analysis that Engels would soon pursue also in Manchester. But it was precisely in this inverted form that these architectural methodologies to investigate the condition of the working class extended into a kind of architectural politics of ameliorating working class suffering and containing the political threat that it posed. As we touched upon yesterday in relationship to housing history in Berlin, this politics was oriented around three primary ambitions. First, legislation on things like sanitation, ventilation, and overcrowding. Secondly, on slum clearance. And third, on the construction of new working class housing. And so, for some reformers, to solve the sanitation problem was to solve the housing problem. And this is exactly what Hector Gavin discovered in the course of his sanitary ramblings through Bethnal Green in the 1840s. According to the then reigning theory of disease, epidemics derived from the noxious gases that emanated from decomposing organic matter. And so Hector Gavin's reforms focused on sewage networks and on waste removal facilities in order to prevent what he called disease mists, like the kind that you see him illustrating here, from forming. Other reformers simply pointed to slums, whatever that term was enlisted to mean, as the problem. And so in the magisterial series of volumes, Life and Labor of the People in London, Charles Booth called the slum a poverty trap, which rendered its occupants disreputable. And so for Booth, the occupants of slums would find themselves on a kind of trajectory where they would fall from poverty and from distress into what he called viciousness and criminality. Some reformers thought that slums should be destroyed in conjunction with constructing new and adequate housing for the poor, but these healthier accommodations were in fact rarely provided, and even when they were, primarily by model dwelling associations, perhaps the predecessors of some of the things that we heard discussed today, they selected out those most in need. As one reformer put it, the poor are not always a desirable class of tenants. And other reformers simply thought that, in the words of one of them, there was little doubt that the sweeping away of the worst slums shoved people into better houses. And so, in a sense, summarizing this trajectory of analysis in his book, The Housing Question, Arthur Wesley Compton declared, "The housing question lies at the root of other great social questions." And in the answers that were given to these questions in Victorian England, I suggest, humanitarianism sought nothing less than its own self-abolition in the fulfillment of architecture. And in fact, architectural history records some of the reforms and some of the proposals that then ensued. But it was just those reforms and just those proposals that displaced or deferred or even inverted the project that was laid out by Engels in The Condition of the Working Class in England, and that formed the target in his subsequent examination of the housing question, an examination in which the housing question was not epiphenomenal, not the question of a crisis that could be averted, but the question of a condition inherent to capitalism, and a condition that we've discussed often these last days. And so, according to Engels, only by the solution of the social question, that is, by the abolition of the capitalist mode of production, is the solution of the housing question made possible. With the consolidation and the expansion of humanitarianism as a political project, and now I'm talking especially about in the decades after the Second World War, attention to the plight of the working class through the housing it inhabited developed into attention to the plight of the displaced through the shelters they were provided. This is a long and complex story, but one of the things that this story records is a shift in humanitarian thought and humanitarian practice, a shift from housing the urban poor to sheltering those displaced in geopolitical emergencies. The turn in humanitarianism from relief to development, and this took place in the 1970s and the 1980s, reanimated a version of the housing question. So this was a moment in which proper forms of dwelling were posed as kinds of preventative measures against the threats and the dangers of disasters. But the housing that would be provided by refugee camps, whether or not it was self-built or mass-produced, I want to suggest might mark humanitarianism's final investment in architecture. And this is because with the still more recent turn towards what has been called voucher humanitarianism, the refugee camp and indeed architecture itself are being replaced by debit cards and by ATM cards and by credit cards that are loaded with funds with which refugees can rent shelter as well as purchase food and other necessities. And so MasterCard and the World Food Program, which have pioneered the humanitarian use of credit cards, have been, for the last few years, providing what they call digital food to Syrian refugees in Jordan. And the United Nations Refugee Agency is providing other refugees in the same way with what I am certain will soon be called digital shelter, which is, of course, nothing other than the housing market itself. In one of the most recent innovations in voucher humanitarianism, all the Syrian refugees who are arriving in Jordan are being added to a biometric database so that when they come to ATMs equipped with iris scanners, they can be identified with iris scans rather than by ATM cards and PIN codes. And this is a regime, I want to suggest, that is in the process of rendering the refugee camp and the world indistinct. In other words, a world in which refugees are simply given funds to house themselves is a world in which the functions of the refugee camp can be accommodated almost anywhere and everywhere. But it's also a regime that renders the capitalist housing market not an emergency on its own terms, in other words, a housing system that's structurally unable to provide adequate amounts of affordable housing, but rather the exact opposite of this. So for humanitarianism, the capitalist housing market has shifted from a problem soliciting humanitarian intervention into a response to humanitarian emergencies. And so with the advent of digital shelter, the world of the refugee is now colliding with the world of the urban working class and poor in Middle Eastern cities where Syrian refugees supplied with allowances for shelter are competing for affordable housing with other marginalized communities in those cities. At the beginning of this year, reports began to emerge of Syrian refugees who were moving from Jordanian cities back into refugee camps. In other words, these were camps that provided refuge not from war zones, but from cities without affordable housing. And so here, in these refugee camps, humanitarian relief was provided to people who were unable to find housing. This was a kind of preliminary collapse of humanitarianism and architecture back into one another. But this is also, I want to conclude, precisely the collapse that refugees have since brought to Europe. That is, in refusing to be objects of humanitarianism and requesting to be subjects of architecture, these refugees are raising not only the question of refugee housing, but the question of housing as such. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew, for this really amazing presenting this parallelity between war and the question of the urban poor. And in a way, you seem to suggest a future where these two categories actually compete on the same market, and the future might be, for all of them, the digital shelter, a kind of voucher humanitarianism, as you describe it, which would probably soon arrive in a city like Berlin.
Was this on? Yeah. Voucher humanitarianism was preceded by the replacement of public housing in many places, like the United States, with a voucher system. So that in the U.S., for example, the end of public housing was accompanied with the introduction of what we call Section 8 vouchers, which is essentially the same procedure that is now being introduced in humanitarianism. So that is indeed a world where it's a world where the housing market is turning into the single and generalized solution to all sorts of all housing issues, including those of refugees.
It's quite a dystopian view, but probably very realistic. And I think within the perspective of what many of us who are architects here in the room, what we have learned in school and university, which was really, as you presented, really injected by some kind of a humanitarian mission. And the answer now is digital shelter.
I think the answer, I mean, yeah, it is dystopian, but I think that maybe the properly political response is to recognize that. Maybe I'll, before I say this, I think it was very interesting here the last 2 days how in a discussion of each of the one-to-one models, at some point, the use of these one-to-one models for refugee housing was expressed. And to me, that was symptomatic of something I'm still trying to figure out. But I think it has to do with... at least one of the things it has to do with is a sense that the refugee crisis solicits refugee housing as a solution. I don't think it solicits that. I think what it solicits is a recognition that refugees are involved in a kind of middle passage from a citizenship that they have abandoned to a citizenship that they want to achieve. And so in that sense, it's not a question of providing refugee housing. It's a question of allowing refugees not to be refugees anymore.
I think we open up directly to the audience here, Sandy.
We have a mic
here.
Actually, what I would like a bit to address and ask about is that what we are really witnessing in the Middle East right now, or at least what we are seeing, is much more collapsing of the cities and the sort of a Middle East made of refugees. And this is one of Middle East made of refugees and completely, I mean, cities like Damascus is not there anymore. Cities like Aleppo is not there anymore. Iraq is completely out of the picture. So we see seriously collapsing of states. And instead of this, a complete replacement of refugees everywhere, and it's obliging us to question the city itself. It's not that we should turn refugees into citizens, much more than we should understand what is the city today that, I don't know if to call it city or a refugee camp, no matter, but what is a place that could refuge people in this moment and sort of host and be a place where they can be accepted, because so far the function of the city is absolutely to reject refugees. So in that sense, I think that we see collapsing of cities. We are in front of a question, what is today a place that could give refuge to all refugees that are all there? And I think that taking the Middle East as a model will sort of help us to understand much better even European cities in that sense. And what a city today that can host refugees, and that we are all refugees at the end of the day, and what is the function of the city, and if it's still possible to speak about cities that is able to absorb and host and give refuge.
I actually completely agree with you, Soundi. I agree with you in the sense that I think it's no longer, it's really becoming neither useful nor productive to distinguish between the problem of the refugee camp and the city, the problem of the refugee and the citizen. I think the problem of the shelter and the problem of housing. I think states, institutions, and disciplines have pried these things apart for all sorts of reasons, and what's happening, as you point out, is that they're collapsing into one another. So yes.
There's a question over there. Yeah.
I hope I will manage to formulate a question around something that has preoccupied me during your lecture, and that adds on to what Soundi said, that is this notion of shift that you refer to that took place in the 50s, where the migrants of capitalism from the 19th century turned into a refugee that is a product of a geopolitical conflict, and I think that there is a tremendous difference between those two. And if I look at an entire region that is made out of collapsed state, it's really entirely different than the modes of discipline that architecture, that function that architecture had in the 19th century to accommodate the Lumpenproletariat in the 19th century. So I think shift is not enough to describe what is going on there.
I respect that. I'll tell you why I think this is. I'll tell you why I'm kind of invested in claiming this. It's because I think humanitarianism claims for itself a kind of exceptionality to work. It claims that it works in exceptional spaces with exceptional populations according to exceptional protocols. And I think. The critical move, it seems to me, is to the defamiliarizing move is to de-exceptionalize its spaces, de-exceptionalize its subjects, de-exceptionalize its procedures. It's to see how humanitarianism is actually enmeshed in and produced by forms of order. And so what that has, so that's why I've been interested in trying to discover a possible counter history of humanitarianism and look at this kind of continuities between what self-avowed humanity mongers were doing in 19th century England with what self-avowed humanitarians are doing today. I'm not sure that answered your question, but it at least explained why I'm articulating that difference as a shift instead of some kind of, I don't know, epistemic difference.
Right. More questions here? Alan? Is there someone else? No. Yeah, here. I didn't see you. Sorry.
Thank you. This is a really interesting discussion, and I think you've hit upon quite an interesting dynamic, because voucherization is this larger process that's also totally connected to financialization, as we've been talking about. I mean, the whole.
What was the first term? The first ism.
Voucherization.
Voucherization. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you can see this as a broader principle and as something that is oriented towards extraction of fees and empowerment of of multinational finance firms and whatnot. So I think this is a really, it was a very astute discussion on your part. What I wanted to ask is, do you think we should reject the term refugee crisis, and what should we replace it with? Because I live in the UK, and there's this crazy sort of politics of language there about how to talk about this phenomenon and how to talk about mobility and also how to talk about these mobile subjects. And people have said the term refugees really doesn't sort of capture this experience. The term migrants doesn't necessarily capture it either. And then there's also, as you pointed to, this concept of crisis, which does suggest something sort of exceptional. So do you think we should reject this concept of refugee crisis, and what do you think we should replace it with?
Well, I think the term refugee, because refugee exists in a kind of, let's say, at least potential chain of metonyms. Refugee to asylum seeker to reserve labor. I think these would be the typical, the way this chain would typically unfold. Which raises the question, what is the destination of this chain? And to me, it seems to be in citizenship. In other words, to recognize the refugee project as a kind of a project of citizenship making, that refugees are citizens in the making. In other words, they're not disturbing, they're not fundamentally disturbing the social order, the state institutions, disciplines. What they're doing. I mean, this is how states, institutions, and disciplines change. They're soliciting that change. When without them, states and institutions and disciplines are fossilized artifacts. So, in terms of, I'm not sure that I have a better word to replace refugee with, but I think I have at least a sense that. To see that word within this kind of metonymic chain, that whose political destination would be a citizenship.
Thank you, Andrew. We have to move on. This was really fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.